Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who's been following you lately, and what have they found out? Even as many of us worry about government overreach chalked up to national security, we've grown accustomed to the idea that the private companies we do business with keep information about those transactions, which in many cases they are free to sell to third-party aggregators. And as my guest today will tell us, a large enough collection of seemingly unconnected facts about any one person can be a goldmine for companies with their sights on our business, from retailers to airlines to hotels and casinos. Adam Tanner is a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. His new book is called What Stays in Vegas: The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Adam, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You open this book with the story of you being tailed by the East German secret police in the late 80s. But when you went back to look at your declassified file, you realized they knew less about your activities and your private life than many U.S. companies probably know today.
That's right. In the mid-80s, I was in Eastern Europe writing travel guidebooks. I wrote the Frommer's Eastern Europe Travel Guidebook. And I had traveled throughout the countries. And after the unification of Germany in 1989, 25 years ago, some years later, I was able to obtain my secret police file, which shows that in a single day in Dresden, one of the great art capitals of the region, there were 10 guys who were following me over the course of a day. And they were jotting down what I did minute by minute. And so the file says something like 9:23, he arrives at the Semper Opera, 10:17, he leaves, 10:19, he's looking at a map, 10:23, he still doesn't know what he's doing, he's asking someone else for directions. 10:37, he goes off to somewhere else. And it notes chronologically where I'm going throughout the day. But even though they have an exact address and moment by moment of what I'm doing during that day, they don't really know that much about me. They don't know really what I'm doing, which is researching a travel guidebook, or they don't really understand that. And they've generated subsequent reports. So, for example, at one point, I go to a hotel to visit it, to look at the rooms, to write it up for the guidebook. They say, this is a little weird. Send a subsequent report to go find out what he was doing there. There's a subsequent report when I stop at a factory gate and I said, was this the building that was a slaughterhouse during World War II? And that was the building that was where Kurt Vonnegut was interned during World War II, from which he wrote Slaughterhouse 5. And that was suspicious enough to have them generate a second report. And so they go back and they say, well, why was the guy here? What did he ask? How did he speak German? And so on. So just that one day is 60 pages of materials in a secret police file. But as I said, it's not that insightful as to who I am, what I'm interested in, and all those things. Today in the United States and increasingly worldwide, marketers have far more detailed insights onto who we are, what we buy, what we like to do, where we live, what our contacts are, and so on. And that's what interested me in this book.
What you just described was also very labor intensive. It takes a lot of motivation and a lot of effort to find that information about you, whereas today, this information is constantly being generated without a human being even having to specifically order it.
That's right. And so in the old communist days, it took 10 guys on that specific day, and then there were subsequent reports. There were people, there were some surreptitious photos taken of me. All of this was very labor intensive. Then you had to type up the report, you had to put it all together. Thanks to electronic communications, it's much easier to gather information with minimal of effort and much easier to store the information. Because back before the computer, the old police files, of course, were in cabinets stored in physical space in massive headquarters for these various agencies. So now marketers are drawing from computers that are logging all the commercial activity that we do and all the public files and other information that they've gathered on us.
What kinds of laws exist, Adam, to regulate the information that companies can collect about us and how they're allowed to use it?
So in the United States, there's fairly limited law as to what who can collect and what they can't do. Most everything they can collect and do freely. The areas where there are limitations have to do with financial data, some medical data, and a few quirky topics such as video rental records. If you're renting videos, they have some protections that most of our other commercial transactions don't.
So for people wondering why the title of your book is What Stays in Vegas, let's move on to that. For a long time, Las Vegas was a place that lived on plentiful anonymous cash. And of course, that has changed.
So I look to Las Vegas as a place to analyze how data is gathered about us, who the people gathering it are, who are the people, and how do they gather it, and what are the implications, for several reasons. One is Vegas is just a fascinating place to start with. But the second is that more public data is gathered in Vegas than in many other places in certain realms. And public data, the things that local and state and federal government gather on us, is a basis for what commercial marketers use. So, for example, in Las Vegas, more people are married than anywhere else in the United States. And there are many famous celebrities who've come through town over the years, and the information they enter there then becomes public record as to what their addresses are and various contacts. And you think of people like Elvis Presley on down. Many have gone through there. Las Vegas is also interesting because there's more video surveillance in the public spaces than anywhere else. A large casino might have 3,000, as many as 5,000 casinos looking both at the customers and at the staff. And also, the casinos are quite interesting in how they've developed very sophisticated consumer loyalty programs. So if you choose to join their loyalty program, they will know a great deal about you, but in exchange, they're going to give you lots of perks and benefits, such as free things at the casino, free meals, free chips, free drinks, maybe a free room, and so on. So it's an interesting array of things that have evolved over time to make casinos in Las Vegas in particular quite interesting to look at for data collection.
How did the folks at Caesar's Palace specifically wake up to the potential value of collecting data to profile their different customers?
So Caesar's has an interesting history. It's a rather old company, one of many in Las Vegas. But in the 1990s, they were trying to expand their operations and grow larger and more successful at a time when very flashy competitors were building impressive casinos, ones with dancing since the 1990s, with dancing fountains and singing gondoliers and replicas of cities abroad at home and so on. What they did was they recruited a former Harvard Business School professor, Gary Loveman, to become first the chief operating officer and the chief and then eventually the CEO, which he still serves as today. And his insight academically had to do with the following. He realized that if you could become a lifetime customer of a company, you would be quite valuable, even if the product you were selling was not particularly valuable. So, for example, if you were a pizza store owner and you could capture someone's business for a lifetime, that dollar slice of the $2 slice may be worth $7,000 or $8,000 over a lifetime. If you're talking about car purchases, someone who's faithful over a lifetime of purchases may be worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if it's something having to do with, say, a corporate aircraft buyer, that might be in the many millions of dollars. As far as casinos, though, this meant that if you could get people to come to your casino consistently with some kind of incentive or reward, then they would be very valuable over time. And the problem in casinos in particular is that the games are largely the same in all the casinos. The electronic slot machines are the same. The ball that goes around the roulette table is going to spin in the same way. The odds are the same in all of these different places, largely. So he wanted to create a loyalty program that would make it more interesting for people to coming back again and again to his casinos and make it rewarding for them in terms of perks and benefits that they would get.
I was surprised to learn that frequent visitors, such as you just described, can in fact be more profitable than the big high rollers that we associate with being courted by the casinos.
So in the olden days, the people who were singled out by the casinos and offered special benefits might have been the people who came with big, flashy amounts of cash. And if they came with $1,000 they spent freely on one night and then came back 6 months later with the same amount of money, they might be recognized and given special rewards, and such as a free room or drinks, tickets to the show, and so on. But what they realized by studying the data about clients is that there were a lot of customers that were coming, spending small amounts of money many times over the year. So a retired woman going to Atlantic City 50 or 100 times a year, spending $100 per time, is a valuable customer. And so by measuring exactly how much she spends over the course of the year, they were able to recognize, oh, there's a whole class of people who are very valuable to us as customers. Let's give them some special perks and rewards if they're willing to share their data with us. Because if the old, retiree woman in that scenario does not join the loyalty program, she can gamble anonymously. She can choose not to share her data, but then she won't get the rewards that the program offers.
And so how much did Caesars have to offer to make it worth it to people to share that personal information?
Well, a fair amount of revenue goes into offering these rewards in terms of free rooms, free meals, free tickets, and so on. Although if you do it cleverly, you can often minimize the actual cost of it. So if you know, for example, that you have 100 free seats to the Rod Stewart concert tonight at Caesars Palace, and you know who your fans of 1970s rock are, you can try to single them out and say, oh, we want to reward you for being a great customer. Let us just give you this ticket to Rod Stewart tonight. So it hasn't cost you anything extra. You may not have sold those tickets, but your clients may become more loyal or appreciative of your casino because of that kind of service.
There are also ways to track who might have had a really bad day and sort of mitigate the pain of that.
So in a casino, especially in electronic gaming, there's exact statistical odds of how much you should win and lose. So it may be that when you put in a dollar in a slot machine, you're going to get 92 cents back or 90 cents back. That's going to be set by the casino, and there's certain rules that guide how much. But there's a flexibility between the casinos as to how much they do that. So they are, if you're in the loyalty program, you stick your card into the machine and they know exactly how much you've spent and they know exactly how much you should be losing by the statistical odds. So if you've put in the card, you've been there 3 hours, a manager can see that you should have lost $217 by that time. I'm just making up a number.
Mm-hmm.
However, if they've seen you've lost more than $400 and you typically lose only $200 in a day, you're having a terrible day, you spent much more than you're typically comfortable in losing, often what they want to do is try to mitigate the pain of that experience. And the mitigation of the pain may be someone comes up at that time and says, oh, Mr. Jones, thank you for coming to the casino. We wanted to give you this ticket for two to go have a steak dinner in our fancy restaurant tonight. Or we want to give you these tickets to the Jerry Seinfeld show tonight or some other perk or benefit. And even though you've lost $417 or whatever the amount is, you may think, oh, this is a great place. I've really enjoyed my time here. So that's how using the data in a sophisticated way can result in both the client being happy and the casino making a lot of money.
And I gather data also drives decisions about how loose the win rates are set on slot machines.
Well, so there's a story here that has to do with sort of a human encounter at the first go-round. Early on in his career, Gary Loveman, then the CEO, was riding in an elevator, and he heard a couple who was complaining about the slot machines in Las Vegas, saying that those slot machines were very tight. They never gave any winnings, and the situation was much better in Atlantic City. So he engaged in a little conversation with them, and then he started thinking, wait a second, the odds in Atlantic City are actually more miserly than here in Vegas. I think at that time they were giving back 5 cents in Vegas. So in other words, if you gambled a dollar, you'd get 95 cents in Vegas, but you only get 93 cents in Atlantic City. So the couple was entirely wrong. Their perception of what was a generous slot machine was not correct. So what he did was he used data to try to figure out whether humans, over a cycle of millions of spins that a typical slot machine does today, could figure out whether or not there could be any difference. And he noticed people could not notice the difference, and thus he set the odds to make slot machines even stingier in rewarding people, setting them to give back 8 cents on the dollar, for example, rather than 5 cents.
Adam Tanner is with us. He's a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard and author of the new book, What Stays in Vegas? The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
That is 10:35, Turn Off Camera 3 by Dave Holmes from the heist film Ocean's 12, which finds the characters moving on, of course, from casinos to European targets. My guest this hour is Adam Tanner, fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. His new book is called What Stays in Vegas? The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Adam, as many people are aware, customer loyalty predated what the casinos were doing, what our stores are doing. Can you tell us about how Hal Brierley ushered in the era of customer loyalty?
So Hal Brierley, someone who lives in Texas, was hired as a consultant by American Airlines. Before the modern-day airline loyalty program, companies that gave out coupons and various incentives, often just such as green stamps, they would give out the stamps for buying a certain amount of goods, but they knew nothing about the clients until the day they arrived and had enough stamps to buy a toaster or whatever. The concept that Hal Brierley was involved in and some of the pioneers of the loyalty programs at airlines was to figure out exactly who were the most valuable airline passengers who were traveling back and forth on the expensive routes. Airlines try to do that initially surreptitiously and try to figure out who is this John Smith going to London every week. But the problem was they were using people were booking with different telephone numbers, maybe the office number one time, the home number, different addresses and so on. So they weren't able to properly link up people. So the insight that they had was they had to offer something in exchange for this personal information that they were going to gather. They wanted to figure out who were these valuable customers. If you would join their loyalty program and thus have the card, they would then give you this bonus of free flights from time to time. So he was a consultant on that for American Airlines. That was 1981. And almost immediately after American Airlines introduced that program, others followed suit. And of course, you had the very fast proliferation since then to car rental companies and supermarkets and hotels and many others.
And I suppose many of us would be okay if it were just that company accessing the data, but you get 48 of them together, and they can create a profile of who we are, what we do, where we go, and what we spend.
That's right. Now, we were talking initially about the casinos. What's interesting about their loyalty programs is, Caesars in particular that I know about, they keep their data in-house. They do not sell it or share it with others because that's their most valuable asset, their insights on their customers. And different companies have different policies whether they share the information. But if you could know, for example, what kind of clothes someone wears and what kind of food they eat and where they go on holiday and all these kinds of things, over time you have a very intimate portrait of people. And so there are data broker companies that gather this information in great detail and have very detailed portraits on hundreds of millions of Americans. Often this data is done in a way that you do not know that it is happening. So what we've been talking about so far are loyalty, customer loyalty programs, where you voluntarily join a program such as an airline loyalty program. You give them the address, your contact numbers, in knowing that you're going to get some reward if you meet the minimum qualifications. Often, though, when you're buying things on the internet or people are gathering data about you, they're taking your information without you consciously knowing that it's being gathered and congregated with other information for marketing or other purposes.
I had not heard of the website aboutthedata.com until I read your book, but I went there. Before we talk about that, explain to people what that is and how you can sign up for it.
So there are very big data broker companies that make billions of dollars a year. And what they do is they collect as much customer information as possible, and they work with other companies to try to target the right people for the right products. So if you're marketing a car, a luxury car, and you wanted to try to find people who might be in the market for an expensive car, you might buy a list from a company such as Experian or Axiom and send direct mail. You might send email. You might contact them or send other incentives their way to try to attract their business. For many years, these companies were very secretive about their actual files. It was virtually impossible for individual consumers to know what their dossier said. And their dossiers can be rather extensive. It can be where you live, who your relatives are, what you buy. It might have your political persuasion. It might have other information about you. There are some data brokers that have medical information, ethnic information, and things like that. So you could turn as a marketer to a company like Axiom and buy information. what Acxiom realized over time, even though it's a company that is not well known by the public, is that increasingly people were coming aware that there was something out there like this data broker thing that they wanted to learn more about. And Congress was beginning to get on the trail of trying to find out more about all these data brokers and what information was being collected. So Acxiom had an initiative before others in the industry to say, well, if you want to look up your own data to see what we have about you, you can come to our site. They set it up a year ago, in fact, aboutthedata.com. And anyone who's listening can go enter in their information, confirm their identity with some details such as social security number, and then you will be able to see at least part of the file that they have about you.
Yeah, so I went, and some of the things came pretty close to being right, but they got a lot of things wrong. My ethnicity, my level of education, my marital status. So these instruments are not perfect.
There's a lot of errors in the data files because many of these companies gather data from a myriad of different sources. They may have hundreds of different streams of data that comes in. So, for example, if someone types in a form incorrectly, it'll go in wrong. If some data is misfiled, it'll go in incorrectly. So I guess you can take some comfort in knowing that your file is not all-knowing and all-perfect, right? Many of the people in my book, Principal Characters, I turned to them later after this site was introduced, and I said, would you mind going and looking up your site and finding out what it says about you? And it was a little like Superman's bizarro world where there are things that are opposite of what the normal reality is. People who didn't have children listed as having children, people who were married listed as divorced, and so on and so on. And there are many reasons for that happening. Earlier this year, the CEO of Acxiom came in and visited my department at the university, and he said that even his own file had errors in it. And he blamed that on the fact that they buy from sources from other places and that there are imperfections throughout the system.
The good people at Acxiom, of course, give you a chance to correct any incorrect facts, and I declined to help them sell me more things. They also allow you to opt out of being sort of tracked and marketed to based on that information. But basically, there's a big warning at the bottom that if you do that, you're going to get a lot of, you know, like male enhancement ads instead of ads for pretty sheets at Pottery Barn, which are what track me around the internet now.
So the direct marketing folks say that they're dossiers about everyone help specify that you will get products that you are interested in finding out. So if you're a man, you won't get products for a woman and vice versa. If you like baseball, you will get products related to baseball. So I think in the broader terms, when I was working on my book, What Stays in Vegas, I was trying to explain the world of personal data and say to everyone who's reading it, there's going to be different levels of comfort when people approach their personal data. Some people will be happy in sharing lots of stuff about themselves. Other people will not. Some people will like having a lot of direct targeted mail, and others will not. And it should be up to the individual to decide. Here's just a small story. It's slightly unrelated, but I was doing some research in Dallas in my book about 2 years ago, and I had a bit of extra time, and I stopped in for a haircut. I went to a very nice place, but as I was coming in, they asked me for my name, my address, my email, and my phone number. And I was thinking, no matter how great this cut was going to be, I'm never coming back there, or it's extremely unlikely I'm going to come back there with any frequency because I live in the northeast of the United States and I don't travel very often to Dallas. There's no need for them to gather that amount of information, no matter how lucrative and alluring their offers to me may be, I'm not going to take advantage of it. So that, for me, was an example of an offer that I declined to give them my information. I was happy to get just the service on that time, right? But other people who live locally may say, oh, this is great. If they give me discounts and products on special days, I'll be happy to participate in that. And the same with something like Acxiom. If you like having targeted ads coming, giving you direct offers, that's something you might want to correct your file. I mentioned before, though, that there's a lot of data brokers that have products that I think people will be quite surprised that they were on those lists. So in my research, I would go to conventions where marketers were presenting their various products for sale to other marketers. And I remember going up to one table and asking, what was this list here? And they said, oh, this is a list of several million men who suffer from erectile dysfunction. And I asked them, how exactly do you have this information? And they said, these men volunteered the information. Now, I found it hard to believe that anyone would volunteer that information, let alone several million men. It may be that they filled out a brochure, or they called in and asked for a brochure, or figured out some kind of health survey, which they believe would offer them coupons and so on. But in essence, then they just became a product themselves for people to market to. Interestingly, I asked that company, well, would it be possible for me to buy a list of 100 or 1,000 names, and I would contact these people and ask them whether they've received useful marketing offers and whether they knew that they were on this list? And they told me that that would be an immoral use of such information, so I wasn't able to ask those people.
You know, it's interesting, too, that many people are told that their personal data is stripped away from things that are aggregated for demographic purposes to help with, you know, marketing campaigns or whatever else. But you discovered that it's really easy to track down, often really easy to track down individuals, even if they've been assured that their personal data is separate and apart from this information about them.
That's right. It's sort of like the easiest way to explain it is maybe looking at a mosaic. If you have a single stone from a mosaic, a single tile, you're not going to be able to figure out the picture. But if you add more pieces here and there, eventually you can figure out, even though you may not have all the tiles. The same works with personal data. Some clues here and there are enough to figure out a lot about someone. So something a colleague of mine at the university, LaTanya Sweeney, figured out some years ago, that if you knew just the zip code, gender, and the date of birth, you can identify about 87% of the American public. And so that means that when you go to a store, for example, and you're checking out at the counter, and you're paying with a credit card, so they see your name, and then they ask you for your zip code, that's often a data-gathering move. They don't need the zip code when they're physically checking you out at the counter. But when they know that you're this person, you're Jennifer Jones from this zip code, then they can pinpoint that you're very likely that person that they have in their database file or that they bought from some other company, and then they can send you offers. So as part of my research, I began to look, well, how much could I find about people based on little bits of data? And there are two different paths I went down. One involved a study called the Personal Genome Study. And this is where several thousand patients have volunteered their medical histories as well as a genome sample so scientists can study and figure out whether there's patterns in various ailments. So it's an important scientific project that could well benefit science. However, there's a lot of intimate information in this, including the zip code they're in, that the gender that they are, and their birth date, those three pieces of information I mentioned before. So I tried to find three people who had very detailed and intimate medical histories. One woman had an abortion. One had been abused as a child. Several of them had used drugs and then had all sorts of fairly minor but embarrassing things if it was put out in public. And I was able to fairly easily identify these people going through other data broker files and identifying these bits of information such as zip code, gender, date of birth, and other information and clues that I had. And then I would call up them. I called them up and said, I'd like to publish your name and these details. Would you be okay with this information? And interestingly, all three of them said, yes, that's fine. Because we had volunteered for the scientific experiment, we had some idea that it could perhaps one day be identified. We're surprised that it's this easy. But a year had passed. And then I said, just before publication of that information, after I identified these three people, put down who they were, what their medical ailments were, and what they did professionally, I was a little uncomfortable because it was such an intimate revelation about these people. So I sent them the small excerpt about them from the book, which I didn't do for others in the book. And I said, before I publish your name, I really want you to make sure this is nothing that's going to cause you distress or any kind of embarrassment. And there were two women and one man that I had identified in this small experiment I did. And the two women were both horrified when they saw their professional affiliation matched with their medical information as I had paired it all together. And so their names I've left out in the book. The one man said that it was fine to continue to use his name. But so even people who've done a lot of thinking about their data and how it could be exposed are often surprised when they see how intimate it all is when you put it all together.
Some people, Adam, who collect and sell this information say, listen, a lot of this is available through public records that are accessible to any American who wants them. But the digital age has made publicly available government data much more public.
That's right. So for many years, public records have been available to us all. And the point of that is that we as citizens want to find out what our government is doing and what information they're collecting on us. And that's why we are open about such records. But things such as, for example, mugshots traditionally are something that might appear for celebrities from time to time in newspapers. But for an average person, you'd have to go down to the courthouse. You'd have to rifle through the files. You wouldn't be able to find them. And so this is an example of a kind of business that have evolved in recent years. And in fact, there's some strong Texas connections there. There's a website called BustedMugshots.com set up by a guy who's based in Austin. And what he has done is he gathers many millions of mugshot photos and he puts them on the internet. He codes them in a way that when you're looking up people's names, they often appear prominently in searches. And it doesn't matter what the crime is. It could be jaywalking or it could be murder, but the mugshot would then turn up prominently. And the other twist of these businesses, especially some years ago when they evolved, was you could then pay him and a few of his rival companies to take down those photos. So it wasn't traditional blackmail where you say, I will do something unless you pay me. This was these photos go up on the internet and when you're horrified by seeing those photos, then you pay him to take them down. So that's an example of using public records in a way that had been unintended when they were initially made public or available to the mass public.
Adam Tanner is with us. He's a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University and author of the new book, What Stays in Vegas? The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with Adam Tanner, a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University and author of the new book, What Stays in Vegas? The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. If you've got a story or a question, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Okay, on to social media, Adam. At this point, most of us understand that whatever we post on sites like Facebook or Instagram or Twitter can spread beyond our intended audience very quickly. But it turns out data miners can make guesses about everything from our political inclinations to our sexual preference, even if we never post about these things specifically.
That's right. So scientists or some researchers at various universities and think tanks have done some studies on what you can infer about people based on their social media profiles. So, for example, who you associate with may indicate your sexual proclivity, even if you've said nothing about it. So if you know a certain if you're among your friends is a certain percentage of men who are gay, that may indicate that you are gay or give very strong indications in that direction. Things as simple as likes can also indicate sexual identity in that way. So not very obvious likes, such as you like the gay men's choir, but who you like in terms of pop music or TV and radio programs or films and so on, this may indicate stuff about your identity that you had not intended to reveal. But it's just, again, these patterns in which many people who have likes just like you have, you've not indicated your sexual proclivity, but it can then be told. It might be your politics or it may be your religion, other things. All these patterns can be picked up in the wave of big data.
Of course, some of this started before people were even aware that they had to be careful about managing their information. And nothing goes away once it's sort of been swept up by the internet, does it?
That's the case. So there's a story in the book, a whole chapter about my effort to find someone based on a single thumbnail-sized picture on the internet. And I'll try to tell a very abbreviated story about it because it's a rather long story. She was, her face was presented as being the spokesperson for a data broker company, but I was becoming suspicious that this person, whose name was listed as Kristen Bright, did not exactly exist, but was a fictitious creation. The only way I could know that would be to find that woman. And what I did was cross-reference through many photos to try to see that photo led me to another. She had a fake name on the internet. I went through many different ways to find out what was that name really leading to. And these were photos of a woman who then it was a headshot, which then led to a photo of her wearing a bikini, and then other photos that were showing this buxom woman in various poses. But it was all natural family stuff. And then there were some topless images I eventually found. And eventually I was able to find this woman. And again, it's a longer story outlined in the book. And I asked her, how is it that all these photos are out there? And she explained that in the early 2000s, before Facebook, she had been posting some family photos on a bulletin board site for families and friends. And eventually she grew to have fans who just thought that she was a beautiful woman. She was married. And they set up their own little side site and so on. And things got way out of control as time went on, and the book will tell that story, and it's maybe not even exactly a story for radio because it becomes a little bit intimate. But these are images that they thought would that they could put up there in the mid 2000s and not have and have them go away or have them under control as much as they wanted to, and then they saw it spiraled out of control as its popularity grew. So the moral of the story is stuff that you put out there is out there forever, and you should give thought to anything you do in a public way on the internet.
The debate recently about celebrity phone, I guess the iCloud accounts being hacked, has been very interesting because there are people who say, well, you just shouldn't ever take a picture like that if you expect to have your privacy. And other people who say, you've got a right to do whatever you want with your personal information and expect that it won't get blasted out there.
So there's a bit of a general generational divide on this question in specific, and that is anyone who grew up with the cell phone and the smartphone may use the phone in a different way when it comes to their intimate personal life than those who grew up in an earlier time. So there are many, many people who now take intimate photos of themselves as part of their courtship and as part of their romancing. And so the fact that these pictures exist for many younger people is not really that shocking. It is a bit surprising for those who are older and who did not grow up in this atmosphere. So what you see in the celebrity release is that younger people have these pictures. Often they're used with within the confines of their home or with their spouse or with a boyfriend or girlfriend and so on. There are instances, though, in which this kind of information has leaked out into the internet also by former spouses and former lovers and so on to humiliate people. So there's a whole category of thing called revenge porn in which deliberately people put out humiliating information. And it could be photos, it could be intimate information done deliberately in a way to embarrass somebody.
What right do we have to say no to the sharing of our information, let alone any kind of intimate photos that people might have, just regular information, and still be able to do business with companies that sell products or services that we want or give them away to us for free? And there's the catch, I think, for a lot of companies.
Okay. Well, I mean, you can say no on a lot of instances. And so I've told you before, you know, in the physical world, I walk into the barbershop and I'm not going to come back to the city very often. So I explain, thanks very much, but I don't wish to provide that. Online, it does take a bit of effort to figure out what people are doing, what firms are doing with the data. And if you don't know and you're not comfortable sharing that information, you might call them up and ask them, do you share my data? How do you share it? And it might be a bank or a credit card company or some kind of shopping company. But you should have some sense of what they do with the data before you share it. Now, things become more complicated when the product is free, because what they're getting out of you is your data, which they're then selling or using to market to you. But I think the companies up until now have not been very transparent into what they're doing about, with our data. And it would be quite simple for a company like Facebook or similar kinds of companies that offer services that millions of people love to say, look, we're very glad you love our product. As you know, it's free. And the way we offer it for free is that we gather as much data about you as we can and try to market ads to you that we think will be of interest to you. And then there'll be a little more clarity about that. I think companies can do a lot better. And it, one of the big problems, of course, is privacy policies. And I've looked at ones that are 5,000 words long that could take 15, 20 minutes. I mean, there are privacy policies that I've brought over to people at Harvard Law School, and they find them puzzling to try to figure out what they mean. So it would be nice to have something like a nutrition label, which you could quickly see. Well, what do you do? Do you share the data? How do you share the data? How long do you keep it? What do you do exactly with my data? And then give you a chance to participate or maybe opt out of certain practices. That doesn't seem like it would be that hard to do. And these are practices, I think, in the long term that will benefit businesses. I think those businesses that are most honest about what they do with our data in the long term will win our trust and win our business.
You explained in an index to the book, or an appendix to the book, excuse me, there are some alternatives to make things like free email a little bit more secure than it otherwise would be.
I mean, there are things to do to secure email. There are things you can do to, for example, there are one-time email services that you can give to different companies. So, for example, I've just bought a new phone from a company I hadn't done business with before. And so the email address that I gave them was issued by a company called Abine, A-B-I-N-E, which generates a different email for each company you do business with. Now, that email will then bounce to my main address. And if they start sending me lots of solicitations that I'm not interested in, I can close off that email. Or if they don't, I'll continue to get the emails bounced to me. So that gives the end user the control whether or not they want to receive emails from that company. There's other email providers that will boost security. So we were talking before about the sharing of the photos or the leakage of these photos last week of the celebrities. There are more secure sites that you can use to bolster the encryption of your data that you upload into the cloud. And I think it's a good idea to look into services like that, especially when it involves intimate photos or important documents or tax returns or papers that are things that you would not want to have leaked out there, medical papers, things like that. So some of the things I talk about in that appendix are some of these encryption services, some of these more secure email services to make sure your security is there and give you the control as the user as to what happens with your data.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Derek on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Derek.
Hi. I just had a comment regarding, I was talking about the sale of the headshots and things like that the magazines do. And it seems to me that even if we have this information available, which we definitely should, that people it should be regulated if people seek to profit off of compilations like this, because while you said, you know, it's kind of like blackmail, it essentially is blackmail in my opinion. So I just wanted to bring that up and think that if, and say that I think it should be regulated if we seek to, you know, profit from it.
Thanks for your call, Derek. Adam, is there much of a move to further regulate this kind of information and how it's shared?
Well, there's been more publicity about this issue of the mugshot websites in the last year or two. The chapter about mugshot websites in my book has this man who's the head of this company, Kyle Prahl, who's never spoken before or since, really, but he details his whole life story and explains how he came to do this and what motivated him. Now, he's been facing various lawsuits and complaints in recent time and has since quieted down again. But because of the publicity of some of these cases, in fact, there's one woman who was on his website who was quite harmed by it, who is from Dallas, that's in the book. There's been calls by various legislators and others to bring some order to this process so that someone cannot punish you a second time. I mean, in essence, the point of the legal system is to punish people for wrongdoing, and that's the punishment. It shouldn't be up to a second person to inflict additional damage. Now, he would probably say he's bringing to light public information that's important to know, but there may be ways in making that information available that would be a little more discreet or not so harming as having your photo, your mugshot photo, come up at the top of website searches.
It seems to me that it's no longer an option for most people in modern American life to opt out of digital communications. Is that something that ought to be on the minds of lawmakers as they consider what to regulate and what to let go?
Well, I mean, no one's talking about opting out of, like, regular communications and using the internet. And I would say that, you know, overall, there are many great things that have resulted from all of this technology. I'm talking about giving more control to the end users and offering more openness about what the whole process is about. And I think that would be benefiting ultimately to the businesses, but certainly to the customers as well. And that's something that will be interesting as legislators look at what could be done. The problem is it's very hard to draw the line of what data can't be used and what data can be used and how it can be used. Are there some kinds of medical data that are fine, but others that are completely forbidden? How do you deal with religion or politics or other issues? There's no clear line, and this is why we need to have a discussion about what we as a society want to be sharing, what we want to be controlled. It's a complicated issue.
How much information do credit card companies share about the specific kinds of purchases that their customers are making?
So financial information is one area where there is more control than in most areas of data collection. But what can happen is that you are marketed to as a broad group. So, for example, they know that these kind of people are interested in sporting equipment, and then you will be marketed to in that way. But generally, they shouldn't be marketing to you because they knew that you have gone and spent $3,000 on golf equipment in the last year. But again, it depends on what you opt in, what you allow sharing from your credit card company. And so it does require taking control does require work on your part. You've got to go read the fine print in the credit card statement and opt out of the marketing stuff if you don't want to receive it. So again, enhancing your privacy takes some effort, but it's worth it if you think it's important to you.
Might there be an option for revenue for companies? Let's just talk about the social media companies to say, okay, we will not sell any information. Nothing will be public. You won't be aggregated, but you pay $10 a month to be on Facebook or Instagram.
I think that would be an interesting model. I was just talking to a medical applications developer. He makes little devices you attach to your iPhone. And he said, my problem is that if I sell the data, I can make the device much more cheaply. And I was thinking, well, why don't you have two prices, the sell your data model, which might be $10, and the we won't sell your data model, and maybe that's $20 or $30. And you give the consumer a choice. So I think that's quite an interesting option for the future.
Adam Tanner is a fellow at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. His new book is called What Stays in Vegas? The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and today by Lindsay Connect with help on the phones from Addie Sun. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show is engineered today by Shelley Canavy. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.